was like set on having a dual role and have kind of a two-arm career, clinical career, be a clinician, but also be an academic and researcher. But that all went down the drain when I was faced with troubles associated with the Civil War. So don't get stressed. Try it out. And don't think that a couple of years down the track, if you are not passionate about this and if you think that was the wrong choice, don't regret it. At least you tried, and at least you know what you don't want to do for the next 35 and 40 years of your professional career.
Hello and welcome back to the Uni Melbourne Student Life Podcast, exploring the misconceptions, realities and developments in careers for our students in the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Science. My name's Dan Revez. I'm a third-year biomedicine student, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Andy Sito, and a fantastic guest who I'll let Andy introduce.
Dr. Susanna is a senior lecturer at the Melbourne School of Health Sciences and the Department of Nursing. Her research focuses on medication safety and quality use of medicine in clinical practice. Additionally, Susanna holds an honorary position as a senior research fellow at the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health, allowing her to maintain a research recency in her subspecialty, neuropsychopharmacology. To date, Susanna has completed over 40 peer-reviewed publications in scholarly journals, book chapters, commentaries, and expert reports. Let's welcome Dr. Susanna to the MDHS Student Life Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for inviting me.
Even for third-year neuroscience students like Andy and I, neuropsychopharmacology sounds a little bit more like a tongue twister than an area of expertise for someone who's a senior lecturer in the MDHS. Could you help break down what this word means and what relevance it has to your work?
Definitely. So when you have long and big words, such as neuropsychopharmacology, you definitely need to break it up. Neuropsychopharmacology. So pharmacology is a topic area that explores the mechanism of action and adverse effect profile of medications used across different ranges of diseases and conditions. Neuropsychopharmacology focuses on medications that are used in the management of neurological disorders, such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and psycho component of neuropsychopharmacology focuses on medications that are used in the management of psychiatric conditions, such as schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorders, depression, bipolar disorder, and a range of anxiety disorders.
I think we're starting to understand it a little bit better. So how would you describe your job to someone who's never heard of a neuropsychopharmacologist before? And what kind of work do you do as a senior lecturer for the faculty?
So I have been appointed to the Department of Nursing to completely redevelop a core curriculum that is taught to nurses working in a mental health setting, so in the psychiatric area of a clinical practice. So I completed PhD in neuropsychopharmacology, and then in 2008, while I was still at the Monash University, I was actually headhunted to come and redevelop this psychopharmacology curriculum for nurses working in a mental health setting. So what I've actually done, I made sure that medications are clearly mapped to a range of different mental health conditions that nurses then can utilize in order to recognize inappropriate medication responses in this subset of vulnerable population. So there is a lot of work that I do in relation to pharmacology in general. My subspecialty is neuropsychopharmacology, so I coordinate and teach psychopharmacology subject, which is taught to nurses involved in the specialty postgraduate programs. However, I also teach applications of clinical pharmacology and quality use of medicines, which is also pharmacology-related subject that is taught to nurse practitioners. And I'm not sure if you're aware that the nurse practitioners are nurses who are now training to be able to prescribe medications. And I also teach pharmacology to nurses working in advanced clinical setting. So you can see that I'm a very busy academic.
Like, I think it's quite interesting, like this whole field of neuropsychopharmacology. I was just wondering whether Did you know that this was something that you always wanted to do, or this, was there a particular event that like sparked your interest in this field?
Well, I have to say, I always knew, apparently since I was 3 years of age, that's what I've been told by my mum and my mother and my father, I always knew that I want to be associated with the medical field. And after completing high school, of course, I have to tell you that I was born and bred overseas. So I was born and bred in Yugoslavia. It used to be a big country, which is now, of course, split up in little republics. So I was born and bred in Yugoslavia, and apparently I always knew that I wanted to go into that medicine-related field. So after completing my high school, I got accepted into medicine, and I did 3 years of medicine. And when I was a medical student, my idea was to actually specialize in psychiatry and hold a dual appointment. So be a clinician, be a psychiatrist, but also be an academic and teach new generation of medical students. So that was always my aspiration and my goal. But unfortunately, in the early 90s, Yugoslavia was faced with a civil war, and I was forced to flee the country. So I ended up in Australia, in Melbourne, as a 22-year-old. And because I couldn't speak the language, I spent 5 years in a factory as a factory worker. So after that, I tried to re-enroll into medical school here in Australia. But of course, that is a very tricky thing to do. And because I was blocked, then I kind of decided, okay, I can't be a clinician in the area of psychiatry, but I can definitely pursue my dreams, at least in the area of research and teaching.
That's an amazing story. I think we talked a little bit before about the challenges that we're all facing now going online compared to having things put into perspective by fleeing from a country and the relative adversity that we face in these circumstances. But definitely. I suppose it does give you some good perspective on how things change in your life and how to adapt and make the most of that in that situation.
Exactly, make the most of it, because, you know, the time passes by very quickly. And imagine someone who comes from third year of medicine, completing third year, and going into the factory where they can't speak the language. And that was myself. And I ended up in a factory where 97% of workers were of Greek background. So they all spoke broken English. So what I've decided is to first learn Greek, to communicate with those people, and then learn English, because I always knew that I'm going to continue my education, and therefore I didn't want to learn that broken English. So my first language in Australia was actually Greek.
A lot of employers today talk about having those key skills, like being adaptable and then having the perseverance there. I think you kind of encapsulated both of them, coming to Australia to learn and then learning Greek in the first place, and then obviously still having that drive to continue and the motivation to continue in the area that you're initially most interested in. I just wanted to come back to the motivations that you talked about in terms of, you said you were always wanting to do medicine and that was something you were really passionate about. Were there any particular people that influenced you to have that kind of view, or where do you think that came from?
I really don't know, to be quite honest, because there are no medical practitioners in my family. I have no idea. I can't answer that question. My late father was a mathematician and physicist, and my mum did economics and commerce. So there are absolutely no medical practitioners in my family. So apparently since young age, I was always drawn to science, and maybe this is the intrinsic nature. Maybe that's my personality. I was always drawn to science, and I was always passionate about the brain wiring. And remember, even when I was going to the high school, I absolutely loved biology and I absolutely loved chemistry. I love maths because my dad was a mathematician and physicist, so I took that genetic aspect from him. But biology and chemistry were my favorite subjects. And I hope you as students can see how biology, the structure, is closely related to chemistry, especially in the domain of neuropsychopharmacology, where altered neurochemical transmission underlies many of those neurological and psychiatric conditions.
I think just speaking from personal experience, in school they teach it as such kind of disparate subjects that you learn chemistry, you learn physics, you learn biology, and then you say they're all separate, but at the end of the day, they're all science as well. And there's no real separating any of them into unique disciplines in a lot of ways, especially when you're studying the body as well. I've had it described as a machine or an engine for a car that you need to learn how it works, how it breaks down over time, which are all processes of physics, biology, and chemistry all together. But I think that's also why Andy and I are maybe so captivated by studying neuroscience as well. It's the kind of unknown, at least for us, that's part of the motivation for studying.
I agree, because there is a lot of unknown. We know so little about those areas because there is only so much in terms of the experiments and the assessments we can do with living human brain. There is only so much. We can't do that much. I mean, with animals, yes, I used a lot of animal models with regard to that neuropsychiatric research. And we are trying to develop animal models that will mimic some of the aspects of those conditions that are seen in humans. But there is only so little that we know about the living human brain.
Coming from like personal experience, because right now, I think me and Dan, we're both doing neuroscience. And I guess all of us, we have some sort of interest or fascination with how the brain works. Just in terms of, I mean, I guess from quite a bit of students, they're still at the stage where they're unsure of what they want to do. Most students, they just choose a major, just think of what's interesting, but they're not really sure whether it's something that they're passionate about. With regards to that, I mean, based on your teaching experience as well, would you have any advice for some students who don't exactly know what they want to do or what they're interested in?
Well, it is hard with the new generation. I'm talking about older generation. I'm not that old, but I'm talking about someone who is probably, I don't know, 25 maybe years older than you. And again, the upbringing in a different country. You know, here you have so many choices, which makes that final decision more tricky and more challenging. So if I go back to 30 years ago, you know, as I said, I was brought up in a communist/socialist country where you had kind of more streamlined pathways and there was no such a thing as a generic undergraduate degree, which you guys now have. And I think completing a generic undergraduate degree has its advantages, especially for those students who are not clear on what they want to do in their life. So if you are not sure what you want to do in life in terms of your professional career, it is good to try different things. And when I say different things, it is really important if you can, in your second year, let's say, of science or biomed, to explore different subjects. Try a bit of neuroscience, try a bit of physiology, try a bit of pharmacology, try a bit of microbiology to actually try to work out what is out there that interests you the most. So my advice would be to be open and don't get disappointed if the major you choose is something that you later on decide not to pursue further. Don't get disappointed because you only get a small snapshot of the, let's say, neuroscience-related content in your undergraduate degree. And therefore, it's really, really important to be open and explore other options. So you said you are kind of aspiring to continue further in the domain of neuroscience. But there might be a trigger down the track where you realize, oh, I really don't know whether this is the right choice. But don't regret what you've done. Do not regret. That's another piece of advice. Be open to other options, explore different subjects, and don't be disappointed if you don't take this major to pursue your career down the track.
That's really good advice. I think a lot of us, we are quite stressed out, especially when it comes to deciding our majors. We are stressed that this will be the decision that we take for the rest of our lives. And I mean, I guess from what you said, that's definitely not the case.
That's not the case. And also, you really don't know what life will throw at you. I gave you my own example. You know, I was like set on having a dual role and have kind of a two-arm career clinical career, be a clinician, but also be an academic and researcher. But that all went down the drain when I was faced with troubles associated with the Civil War. So don't get stressed. Try it out. And don't think that a couple of years down the track, if you are not passionate about this and if you think that was the wrong choice, don't regret it. At least you tried and at least you know what you don't want to do for the next 35 and 40 years of your professional career.
Did you have many of those kind of moments that you talked about yourself in terms of finding those things that you perhaps don't want to do as well, and some of those triggers for finding what you really enjoy? Did you have some of those moments yourself?
I did.
Some of those revelations?
I did. And I will share one of those. When I was a medical student, as I said, you know, you go on different clinical placements as a medical student. And as I said to you, I always aspired to be in that area of neuroscience. You know, the brain wiring, the chemistry, the biology, mental health disorders, neurological disorders. And when I was on a clinical placement, I can't recall, was it the second or third year of my med degree? I actually wanted to try other areas of medicine. I thought, what about cardiology? What about pediatrics? You know, I was questioning myself and I was trying to explore other options, because it is really critical for all of you guys to be open, open to new ideas, open to new horizons. And I did try pediatrics and I have realized that no way I would be able to work in that setting. Why? Because I saw these little creatures, little babies, little kids, who was so sick and so unwell, and yet they did not have any risk factors. They were not at fault. What I mean by that is that, look, if I smoke two packs a day for 35 years, well, I'm expected to develop some sort of pulmonary or lung condition, yeah? If it's not cancer, maybe it's something else. Or if I eat unhealthy food, high sugar content, high fat content food for 25, 30 years, I'm overweight, well, I'm expected to develop some endocrine abnormalities such as diabetes. Yet those little creatures that were brought into this world did nothing wrong. They didn't smoke. They didn't eat bad food. They were not exposed to other environmentally dangerous risk factors, and they were so unwell. And some of them died. And that was the point where I realized that's definitely an arm of medicine that I would never be able to work in.
It's the cruelty of life in a way when you have that situation, when you really, really can't do anything about that. But I guess it's a little bit more of a motivation to go into those areas, like you talked about, where you can study the mechanism and hopefully see some outcomes in what you do with the actual patients and clinical practice as well. So you talked a little bit about the interaction between teaching as well and clinical practice feeding on from science. How important is it for you today to have that evolving teaching method? And you talked about the restructuring of the nursing program, but even to have doctors today that have more of an inclination to become clinician scientists rather than specializing in one role just as a clinician, but also viewing everything overall. How important is that for you?
Oh, that's absolutely critical, and that's why I'm so passionate in terms of what I do for those clinicians. And as I said, I teach nurses predominantly, but I also teach physiotherapy students, because I teach into one of the subjects within the School of Biomedical Sciences called Pharmacology for Health Professionals. And I think it is absolutely critical that clinicians are involved in some form of research, because that is the only way to actually improve the patient outcomes, improve the patient safety. Because when we are talking improving patient outcomes, what does that mean? In relation to my area of interest and my work focus category, pharmacology, that is directly tied with medication safety. So we know that medication errors account for approximately 3% of all Australian hospital admissions annually. So 3% is quite significant. And this also is reflected on the global and international level. And I think there are some sort of rough or estimate figures that about 230,000 patients are admitted to hospitals on annual basis just because of medication errors, which costs up to $1.2 billion annually, but it's also associated with severe harm. And about, I think, 3% of those patients die. So therefore, clinicians need to kind of have a good understanding, overarching understanding of the current evidence-based practice that will then aim at reducing those medication errors, decreasing the hospital admissions, and at the end, improving patient outcomes.
I think it feeds a lot more into what we're encouraged to view in terms of the future of healthcare as well, in that, especially perhaps more in Melbourne, from perhaps what is a biased perspective that Andy and I have, is to view the evidence first and evidence-based clinical practice being the forefront of what we should really be doing to achieve the best outcomes. But I think also Melbourne has quite an emphasis on research and encouraging students to go into that area as well, and to feed off both as very useful things. I'll just finish up as well. In terms of asking the question, for anyone that is interested in some of the topics you've mentioned today, how would you suggest that they get involved? And also, how do you think that this area is going to develop in the future?
Oh, well, in terms of the future developments, there is a huge potential. And you can see now in this COVID-19 pandemic, we are looking for vaccines at the moment. So that is also related to drug development and clinical trials. Maybe in the future, we will be looking for new drugs that will actually treat and manage these virally caused infections. So there is a huge potential, and I'm, of course, focusing on my work category, pharmacology. There is a huge potential in this area. And if students are interested in any kind of pathway that is associated with drug development, with clinical trials, it is really important for them to get in touch with academics who are involved in these areas. So don't be shy, don't be afraid contacting an academic and saying, "Hi, Snezana, I've seen your profile on Find an Expert at the University of Melbourne website. I'm really interested in this topic. Can you provide me with some advice? Can I meet with you? Can I do some internship? Can I do some reviews of the papers?" It is really important to make that first step. Because what I still feel that a lot of students across the board at different universities, not just at the University of Melbourne, think that we academics are some form of aliens, that we are untouchable, that we are unapproachable. And, you know, they are sometimes kind of fearful of making that first step. But what I really want to send across, the message I want to send across, is that despite the existence of power differential between an academic and a student, we must work together. We must work as partners, because building strong partnership is actually a solution to complex problems. And for students, complex problem could be not knowing what to do and where to go further. So bringing together and building these strong partnerships between students and academics is the only way forward. We are together on this journey. And do not forget, please don't forget, even if you think that we are unapproachable and came from another planet, that we are your teachers. We are your biggest supporters. We are your biggest supporters. And we not only bring our content expertise in a tour that we take you on, but we also bring our own personalities and our own experience.
So you're currently involved in establishing the new academic advising program for the university. Could you tell us a little bit about that and what students can expect from that program?
Well, I'm thrilled to be involved in that program. I'm absolutely thrilled to contribute to the development of academic advising at the University of Melbourne. And I do believe that this is a great initiative in terms of providing support to our students and also making sure that our students develop that sense of belonging and understand that we care about them. For me, that is a really, really important point that students of all that academic advising program, because many students think they are just a number. They think, oh, I'm just a number at this university. Oh, academics, Nezana, oh, she doesn't care about me. And I'm hoping that with this academic advising at the University of Melbourne, we will be able to change the perception some students have about their place at the university, develop a strong sense of belonging to the community, not necessarily to neuroscience or microbiology or pharmacology, but the sense of belonging to the University of Melbourne community, where you can actually go and take different pathways, contact different people in order to widen your horizons.
I think Andy and I probably found that a little bit as well. We've discussed that once before in a previous episode that we recorded, that we came to university. For me, I came from a biology class with four people in my high school, and then coming to university, having 100 or more students in one lecture was a big change. And you do feel a lot more insignificant. And you also feel that the people you're with are of a much higher caliber. And you realize, oh, for the first time in 5 or 10 years, I'm not the smartest person in my class. And there's a lot to be learned. So it's definitely an interesting and difficult transition. But yeah, I'd just like to thank you today for sharing some absolutely amazing insights. I think we've really appreciated it. And also to hear your stories and ideas have been fantastic. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I hope we can continue this partnership and collaboration. And you are right. There is a big transition between a high school and the university. But you need to take out that layer of being the smartest or being the tallest or being the biggest expert in this area. You have to take that layer out of the equation and come in with open views, aspirations, and don't be afraid of trying different things.